Okay, good afternoon, everybody. And it's my great pleasure to head north of the border to BCE, and delighted to welcome Glen LeBlanc from BCE here this afternoon.
Thank you, Simon. Great to be here.
Please note that all important disclosures, including personal holding disclosures and Morgan Stanley disclosures, appear on the Morgan Stanley public website at www.morganstanley.com/researchdisclosures or at the registration desk. Well, it's great to have you down here now because there's a lot going on at the industry level, at the regulatory level, but also at the company level as well. And George has been in place for over a decade and has handed the reins over to Mirko. So perhaps maybe just start with the transition there and the priorities for Mirko and for the organization for 2020.
Sure, Simon. Look, the transition has been extraordinary. It's been seamless, and it's really kudos to George and Mirko. This started a number of years ago with ever-increasing responsibilities for Mirko and a healthy transition as he was becoming more and more involved with different facets and areas of operation of the organization. And, you fast forward to January 6th, which was Mirko's first day, and it felt like he had been CEO for months, and I think that is a credit to George and wanting to ensure that the organization was in good hands and it was in good shape when he left. As far as when you look at the priorities of our organization and the strategic imperatives and what we're focused on, I would say that over the last 24 months, Mirko's fingerprints are all over the strategic imperatives as he helped shape them and develop them. And although there's no significant change in any strategic direction, naturally we're going to continue to build the best networks, focus on our customers, and ensure that we're supportive of the dividend growth model that we have in our company. What I would say is when you have a transition that's managed so well as this one, that there's not a flash cut to the strategic priorities. These are Mirko's strategic priorities, and I would say because we have such a consistent leadership team and that there's been so few changes at the executive table, these are the leadership team's strategic priorities.
Great. All right. Well, let's start with maybe the networks then. And if we start on the wireless side, one of the big themes here is 5G. So perhaps update us on your 5G plans. And, I guess that ties into also, you're not going initially with Huawei, but, the government decision on what vendors you can use.
Well, it's no surprise, Simon, that our strategic priorities focus on building of the best networks. And as you allude to, 5G will be no different. I think no one's in a better position than we are to continue that leadership position, including 5G. When I think about it, I think of 5G as starting a number of years ago, and that was the construction of our fiber backhaul. And when we look now with almost 90% of our cell sites having fiber backhaul, we find ourselves in an enviable position heading into 5G. Now, I think there's been a lot of talk, and maybe one could argue marketing fodder over 5G in calendar 2020. Let's be honest, real 5G is not going to be in place until we have 3.5 spectrum auction, and that's probably the auction will occur, I believe, in calendar 20 and likely deployment in 21. And what we see in 2020 is going to be a limited handset, and frankly, probably at speeds that are no greater than the LTE speeds we offer today. So true 5G is going to be in 2021, and we're delighted with the position we find ourselves in. We'll continue to make that fiber backhaul investment. We'll continue the cell splitting that we have been doing for a number of years, and we'll ensure that we're ready for the 3.5 auction. Now, we're in a great position having about 25 or 30 megahertz spectrum already from our Nookshook JV heading into that auction, so a great place to be.
Okay, and what's your sense of how much you'd like to get in that auction?
Well, as much as possible would be my sense. And I think the fact that we've been managing our balance sheet, we certainly didn't take any actions on 600 that put us behind the eight ball. From a balance sheet perspective, we're healthy.
Yeah.
We've got the strongest balance sheet in the industry, and we'll ensure that we get the required 3.5 spectrum However, let's see the rules come down, because
right.
there's been all kinds of speculation that there'd be caps and set-asides, and at this stage, we don't know that.
And if you're going to have it in calendar 20, you need to see those pretty soon, I would assume.
I think we're going to see those in the coming weeks for certain.
Good. Okay. And then on the vendors, I mean, we did see a decision out of the UK government. Do you think that might be a template for the Canadian government?
Or? I think it could be. I think our message to our government has been a simple one, is that that through the supply chain process and the vendoring process, a healthy tension is important. We have historically used Nokia and historically used Huawei, and we think that serves Canadians well. That served us in getting the prices we need. And frankly, Huawei has been a superior technology, and we think we would be remiss to deny Canadians that. It's never been included in our core, and it is not our proposal to include it in the core go forward. It would be in the radio access layer. Because it's so important to continue our network leadership position, we made an announcement that we would be proceeding now with Nokia as our first supplier choice, only because the government's decision in Canada has not been made, and we can't be put in a position of waiting. But we have no Nokia in our network today, and our hope would be that the UK model is sort of a template to what we could do in Canada and to ensure Canadians have access to the best technology.
And there's some investors concerned about a rip-and-replace requirement. Do you think that's off the table?
I don't believe anybody would go there, as it wouldn't serve Canadians well to do that. I think in areas where it's been the government's choice not to use Huawei or to choose to have Huawei not included, there's a path to have that equipment replaced over time, and I think that if we went there in Canada, I certainly hope that would be the path.
We've heard a lot of different use cases thrown around. We've got Verizon's trialing with Walmart. We've had industrial IoT, a lot of fixed broadband, home broadband. So what are the things that excites BCE the most?
Well, I think in the early days, you'll see it utilized in the business markets first. The use cases that we're seeing, the obvious ones, obviously, in the future, autonomous vehicles, smart cities, monitoring. We've done some work with organizations where propane tank monitoring. And when you think about industries that have a lot of windshield time and a large fleet, and they're moving their fleet around, and a great example of that is propane, where you're sending your fleet out to check on the need of propane on multiple residences or businesses. And frankly, if a monitor could tell you where to send those vehicles in an efficient manner, the optimization of fleet it would be phenomenal. And I think that's a very simplistic example of what these Internet of Things and these monitoring tools can do, and we're doing trials there. We're doing trials with smart cities, and we're signing up right now with some of the large fleet manufacturers. So we think there's opportunity that's going to develop in autonomous vehicles ultimately.
One of the stats that I think always surprises people is how low Canadian wireless penetration is. It's one of the lowest in the sort of developed world, and
just over 90% right now
would tend to give you comfort about the ability to grow into that. I mean, what do you think that was driven by? And are you comfortable that over time you should be able to approach? I mean, your broadband penetration is, I think, higher than the U.S. So why shouldn't your wireless be?
Yeah, I absolutely think it's only we're a lag to the U.S. in many fronts, and wireless is one. I think we're at around 91 or 92% wireless penetration right now, where we see the U.S. closer to 120, I believe it is now. I think we were in Canada. Multiple devices was a slow adoption, where we're starting to see that pick up now, where Canadians will have one for personal usage and one for business. I think the U.S. were way ahead of us on that, and that fuels a bit of the difference. I think if you looked at penetration in urban centers in Canada, it probably mirrors a little closer to the U.S. But there's, in the suburban and more rural Canada, I think there's a great opportunity for us for continued wireless penetration. So, I think that the runway is still there in front of us for certain.
Right. And, the population growth's been good, the penetration's been good, but I guess the industry, which had been so stable for so long, it seems like it's had these kind of...
An interesting 6 months.
Well, and even 18 months,
yeah.
It sort of feels like we've had these kind of sporadic firefights, if you want to call them that. And, where are we today? Are things in a more level environment now? And we've heard earlier about a super cycle maybe with, the iPhone 5G later this year. Do you think things could ramp up again then?
Look, it's always been competitive in Canada, and it moves in ebbs and flows. I would say we're very excited about the runway in front of us, and we talked about penetration, but we also think there's still some great opportunity in Canada as we look at bandwidth consumption really exploding. What's transpired in the last 6 months is interesting, and if we go back to the middle of 2019, the introduction to Unlimited, and that probably accelerated faster than we desired. Frankly, I don't know that there was a need to move so quickly to elimination of data overage or moving to Unlimited. That said, it will serve customers well, and it will serve Canadians well in time. We've heard our competitors say, and we've echoed that you will have an increase in customer satisfaction. You'll have reduced calls to contact center and an improvement in the customer experience and ultimately an improvement in churn. I believe all of that will happen. I think the pace of which we needed to move there could have been slower, and I think what you heard us say on our most recent analyst call is that we're trying to manage that pace. And we've done a very good job of managing the pace such that the decline of data overage is probably going to take us a couple, 3 years to really feel in its entirety. And I think that's the right move for shareholders.
And remind us how much it is of your service revenues?
About 5 to 6%, I think, of total service revenues. And, I think our largest competitor in Canada said there was approximately somewhere between $90 and $100 million of lost revenue in the second half of 2019. And I would say ours is substantially less than that. So I think that's important that we manage the pace of this. And you're seeing it in our ARPU, and that ARPU is going to be, it's going to be quite low, the growth, and essentially around flat as we absorb this change and movement to Unlimited. However, at the same time, a shift that's occurring in Canada is a movement to EIP, and I think that's very, very healthy for the industry as a whole. It's an opportunity for us to really claw back some of this escalation in subsidy. And that's what's happened. If we look back over 3 or 4 years, the subsidy of a device, the device landed cost may have been $500 or $600, and you fast forward to today, and they're north of $1,000. And when you're looking at a Canadian spot at $1.33 today, the landed cost of these are $1,000 to as much as $1,300. Yet we in Canada found a way to bring the cost of those devices to zero at some point throughout the year, no matter what, whether that be back to school promotions or Black Friday or Boxing Day. And I think the movement to EIP is going to be very, very healthy. I think it's going to allow us to separate the airtime packages from the cost of the handset. And I think that transparency is healthy for consumers to realize what the cost of this device is, to put the power back in the hands of the consumer, to select the device that they so choose. And we'll finance that for them, but there is a price.
And unlikely hold it longer.
They'll likely hold it longer, which is good for industry churn. But I think we have a great opportunity here to improve the cash flow and to improve the EBITDA with EIP. Will that potentially slow transactions? Yes. Will that slow revenue growth? Yes. But does it generate a higher and healthier margin and healthier cash flow? I think the answer to that as well is yes.
And you're talking about handsets. Any early updates on supply chain or inventory levels or anything
like
that?
At this point, no concern, but it's a great question. And if the coronavirus continues to escalate internationally and here at home in the U.S. and Canada, I think it's suffice to say that it's only a matter of time before you're going to have some inventory issues. Frankly, we're not in it alone, and if there is inventory issues, our competitors are going to face the same issues. In the short period of time, that probably means a reduction of churn and a reduction in upgrades, and
Lower marketing spend?
A lower marketing spend, and frankly, probably a short-term improvement in cash flow. Heaven forbid if it goes on for a long duration of time, how that has substantive impacts on the industry. But I think way too early for us to jump to that.
Yeah.
And as I say, it's not like BCE is behind our competitors in inventory. We would have every bit of what they have and access to whatever is out there globally.
And we've just gone through the MVNO hearing. So what's the kind of the internal kind of conclusion of where we are stand today, and what's the next step in terms of learning what the next steps are?
Well, I think we're months away, six maybe as much as 9 months away from maybe knowing where the government's position on this. But I will tell you, to paraphrase what came out of the hearing, is we're all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
And for maybe for the first time, an issue wasn't the incumbents with one voice and the new entrants with a different or secondary voice.
Yeah.
This was a loud voice from all that says that, you know, we pride ourselves on having maybe the best wireless networks in the world, with the exception of South Korea. And we didn't get here by accident. We got here by investment, and we're continuing to make sizable investments in these networks to have access to these great networks for Canadians. The government spoke at great length over the last decade about their importance of the fourth wireless player, certainly demonstrated that by spectrum set-asides, as much as the incumbents were in disagreement with that. And here we are just starting to see the fourth wireless player take a foothold in many markets across Canada. The introduction of MVNO would be so destructive to that foothold. It would be so destructive to continued investment by all of us, incumbents or fourth wireless player. I think it places in question the value of spectrum. How do we value spectrum if we're not sure about how the MVNO world evolves? So I remain convinced that rational minds will prevail, and that a facilities-based reg environment is what served us so well, and that we would be irresponsible to move beyond that model, and Canadians will suffer.
And did they give any hint or any sort of tea leaves or?
Absolutely not. I think I thought every one of the presenters on the incumbent side or the new entrant side voiced grave concern about future investment, and I don't think that will fall on deaf ears.
Great. So if we pivot to the wireline side, you've mentioned the five investment there, and that's shown through in your broadband ads. There's other cross currents in terms of pay TV. We've heard a lot about OTT here today, this conference, and some enterprise pressure. So where does it all wash out in terms of what we should expect for 2020?
Well, I think 2020 is a lot more of the same. We're at 5.1 million premises connected with fiber now. Ultimately, that's about 53% of what we would deem a viable footprint of 8.5 to 9 million homes covered with fiber. We have about 1 million homes we'd like to complete with wireless to the home. So at about 700,000 a year would be our objective, and 2020 is the same size footprint expansion. The next 5 to 7 years will be about network completion and ultimately getting to what will be, from my perspective, a rebuild of a 140-year-old copper network. And you come out the other end of this, we will have future-proof technology and fiber at a time when networks are truly converging, and when we talk about 5G and wireline. So the focus for us will be just more of the same, continuing to roll out. When you roll out fiber, the marketing or market share perspective, in my mind, is simple. You should take 50% of net new ads in any community where you have fiber. Why wouldn't you? If you have technology parity, or what I would argue would be technology superiority, why wouldn't you take market share? So in many of these markets where we're rolling out fiber, we had network inferiority for many years, and cable company took share. So it's our turn to take back that share. So I see as the future being bright is to just more of the same. Keep rolling out fiber. Keep taking share where you roll out fiber. All of that's, of course, when you're taking internet share, we believe there's a healthy video pull-through. But all of that's occurring at the time when we're continuing to see declines in legacy and home phone and reprice in the enterprise space. So, you know, trying to eke out low, low single-digit growth and just try to stay positive on revenue and positive on EBITDA is our focus, and ensure that all three of our segments contribute to positive EBITDA, positive free cash flow. And if you can do that with all three segments and support that 3-7% free cash flow growth generation that you've become accustomed to seeing from us in our guidance, then that supports the ability to grow the dividend at approximately 5%. And I think that's our focus, and we think very doable.
And that implies capital intensity is fairly stable over time? Or?
And it should be. It really, at the approximate $4 billion we spend a year, or roughly 16.5% intensity, you know, we can comfortably build at a cadence of roughly 700,000. We can comfortably roll out 5G, and although we think 5G will intensity, wireless intensity will bump up closer to 9-10 from the 7-8, that's a few hundred million easily absorbable inside a, you know, 16.5% intensity. And the network sharing agreement is very, very powerful for us, and having that with TELUS, I think, gives us a 3-4% differential on wireless intensity to our largest wireless competitor.
And that all translates, you know, seamlessly to 5G?
It sure does. As important as ever is to have that network sharing agreement for 5G.
And what about wireless broadband regulation? Any thoughts on what we should expect?
Well, you know, we have an appeal, and we believe that the rates are not representative of cost. And we've expressed with the government that it's very much the same as what's transpiring with wireless, is that our government desires a connected Canada, and we desire the same. We desire that every Canadian has access to high-speed internet and networks of the future. But the areas that are suffering most, as we know, are rural. With a landmass the size of Canada, the areas that need broadband and need investment in the future are going to be the rural areas. These type of decisions are going to stifle investment, and they're not going to stifle investment in urban centers. They're going to stifle it in rural. And I believe it actually is counterintuitive to what the government is doing with the Connect to Innovate Fund. The government are creating these large broadband funds where they're encouraging organizations like BC to apply for subsidy. And the subsidy's design is to cover the uneconomic portion of construction in rural areas. Well, as you offer these broadband wholesale rates, you've just increased the size of the uneconomic portion of the build, because I can't get adequate return on that investment. So it's a bit counterintuitive. In the simplest of sense, if we were going to split the build 50-50 in a $20 million build, maybe the build is going to be 20-80 now on the government's dime, because it no longer makes sense.
And any timeline on the appeal?
I'm hopeful for 2020.
Yeah.
But again, that's in the hands of government.
And one of the highlight or the features of you know, George's leadership was a large, you know, roll up strategy on the telco, on the wireline side. Are we kind of done with that now? Is there any other opportunities to continue to work that playbook?
The consolidation strategy in Canada has served us so well with the acquisitions of CTV and Astral and Bell Alliant and MTS. But Simon, as you alluded to, when you look across the Canadian landscape, there's not a lot. Will we always be looking for opportunity to create shareholder value creation with little tuck-ins? Yes. Do I think there's material acquisitions that remain? Probably not. If we look at Canada, the only independent that really exists of any size is in Saskatchewan. And should the government ever decide that was something they wanted to spin out, naturally, we're going to look and we'll be there to kick tires. Beyond that, I think the best way we can create value, wealth creation for our shareholders right now is investments in best networks, and that's where we're going to focus. So, you know, opportunity presents itself, will be there, but I would certainly say that the next decade will be quieter than the previous decade on the M&A front.
So when Mirko reiterated the dividend growth forecast, I'm assuming that you and he and the board had a long discussion around the pros and cons. I mean, you could mix in buybacks, you could change your leverage target, you could do a lot of different things. You elected to follow this. So help us just understand the whole capital allocation. We're seeing AT&T do a lot of buybacks now. Given where rates are going, paying down debt at pretty low coupons, from an equity investor point of view, that may not be as exciting. The rating agencies, I'm sure, would like it.
For me, it's about balance. Yes, they would, I would think. But for me, it's about balance. Ultimately, it's our board's decision, and we do visit with the board on multiple times throughout the year. And anytime we make a decision annually to raise the dividend, that ultimately does lie in the hands of the board. But what I will tell you is this, is we know who our shareholders are, and we know our shareholders expect a consistent and a dependable and predictable dividend from BCE and a dividend growth. And that is our desired end state, and that hasn't changed under Mirko's leadership. But I would tell you that growing the dividend has to be done in an affordable manner, and I defined affordable as not on the back of the balance sheet. So you can't be borrowing to fund a dividend growth. So respect the payout ratio of 65% to 75%. I think we've served our shareholders well with a healthy shareholder return, and we've been able to do that and didn't require buybacks. Your observation on leverage, we're outside of our targeted leverage range, but comfortably inside of the BBB high rating we have. And when I just did a 30-year issuance at 3.5%, and I never in my life thought we would be doing 30-year issuance at 3.5%. I'm not in a rush to pay down debt when the coupons look like they do. But I also never want to take on actions that put us up against potential downgrade. You want to ensure your balance sheet's healthy enough to participate in the absolute required spectrum auctions we have in front of us. And I think we're there. So, I go full circle to balance. You can't choke off a capital program. We have fiber to build and 5G networks to build. So I would never want to fund a dividend on the back of CapEx reductions. I don't want to fund a dividend in the form of leveraging and constant leverage to pay for it. So this focus will be respect your payout ratio, respect your credit rating and not taking actions that jeopardize that, respect the capital that this business requires to invest in, and that's called balance. You do that inside an affordable payout ratio, and I think everybody wins.
Great. Yeah, 3.5% sounds nice. So maybe we just wrap up quickly on the media business. What are we seeing in advertising and the economy broadly?
I couldn't be more pleased with the last 15, 18 months in our media operations. 2019 was a bit of a honeymoon, if you will, as we watched advertisers return to more linear platforms away from digital and back to television and even radio. Our media operation performed exceptional. I would certainly say I don't think 19 is indicative of what you should put in your model for 2020 when we were having mid-teens growth in revenue and EBITDA in many quarters. But I do see health. I see an organization that is healthy. I see an organization that's contributing, and my focus, I mean, we have to remember it's a $850 million EBITDA business that has approximately $100 million in CI, or capital. That business spends an awful lot of cash for BC and helps fund fiber, it helps fund 5G, but it has to be a contributor. In my mind, media has to continue to demonstrate that it is a contributor to the consolidated 2% to 4% EBITDA growth that we want. It's a contributor to the 3% to 7% free cash flow growth that we need to respect the dividend and fund the dividend, and it's doing just that. And that operation is performing exceptionally well right now, and really fits our aggregation model.
Great. Well, Glenn, great rundown. We really appreciate your time today.
Simon, really a pleasure being here. Thank you.
Thank you.